Welcome along, I fancy exploring. How about you? Let's search out the secrets of the solar system. It's a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan, so happy to have you along. It's our club of explorers. We try and find all those strange bits of science that lurk all around. This week we will carry on our battle of the sciences and hear why the geniuses that look at your body are the best.
So anatomy is one of the oldest sciences known to man. It dates back to the ancient Greeks, the ancient Egyptians, and before. It's a science that involves examination of the body, and that's the body as we look at it, as we look at each other and ourselves in the mirror, or our siblings, our family members, and seeing the differences on the surface.
Also, are you allergic to something? I don't know, maybe pets or foods or nuts or pollens? Well, you can find out why.
There are two aspects to it. One is the food or the allergen in question. So some tend to be generally more allergic than others. And the other thing is how your immune system tends to see them.
And you can hear why space is so very cold. It's a brand new week of the bigger and better than ever Fun Kids Science Weekly. Let's kick things off with your science in the news then. This week we said goodbye to a pioneering satellite. The ERS spacecraft has studied the Earth for more than 30 years. It looked at the land, the ocean, and the changing climate. And now it's done. A few days ago, the 2-ton spacecraft fell to Earth and it completely burnt up in the atmosphere. No one spotted any falling remains or debris. It's completely gone. Amazing, isn't it? This thing has been up there for like 30 years since the 90s and has really helped what we do and has paved the way for bigger and better spacecraft, which is taking over now. Also, the first breeding population of an incredibly rare turtle has been discovered in India. Conservationists found the nesting site of the very secretive Cantor's giant soft-shell turtle. It's native to the rivers of Southeast Asia, and it's critically endangered. It was found in a river in Kerala, which is right in the south of India, and this is a big deal, like randomly stumbling upon a critically endangered animal. Not just that, but they're making babies is a brilliantly good news for science and for animals all around the world. And our last story today, a completely unbroken chicken's head from 1,700 years ago has been found during a dig in the UK. And it's the only one that we've ever found from Roman Britain. Let's find out more. Edward Biddulph is an archaeologist on the team. Edward, thank you so much for joining us. Just tell us, how was this found?
Thank you for having me. It was found during excavations by Oxford Archaeology some time ago, in 2010, actually, at a site which was going to be built for houses. And the archaeologists were there and they found a pit which was full of water and mud and perfect for conditions for preserving the things that don't normally survive for so long. And one of the objects we found was this complete egg. And actually it was found with two others, and there was a fourth, but it wasn't quite with this clutch of eggs. And those three eggs were complete. But on excavation, when it was exposed to the air, two of them disintegrated and released a very smelly, eggy smell, much to the disgust of the excavator. But we managed to retrieve this, just one of the eggs, which was amazing because, as you say, nobody has found a complete egg that's so old in Britain, which is absolutely amazing.
Well, I don't know if I'm missing something here, Edward. So this started back in 2010, yet we're hearing about it now 13 years later. What's been this long process? What's happened?
Well, actually, it takes a long time for the results of the excavation to really sort of come out into the public. The story of the excavation to be told to the public. We had to do a long period of post-excavation work, we call it, which is all the writing up, the analysis, trying to understand what we have. But this particular story came up because we've done all that. We wrote the story of the site, if you like. And then all the finds, end of last year, were then taken to the local museum in Aylesbury. And still a question remained, how do you conserve an egg for long-term storage in the museum and actually also put it on display without it breaking? This led us to do a scan of the inside of the egg, a CT scan. And this showed that the egg amazingly had liquid in it. And that may be the remains of the yolk and the white of the egg, which if the whole egg was unique in Britain, having a Roman period egg that still has some trace of its liquid inside is pretty rare on a global terms, it's pretty unique in the whole world. So this was amazing. So we didn't know this when we first wrote up the site. It was only when we were starting to think about conserving the egg for display or whatever that we discovered it still had this liquid in.
Talking about conserving it, just, I guess, briefly, what would conditions need to be like to perfectly preserve an egg for 1,700 years underground?
Well, I said it was in this wet pit full of mud and water, and that pit had been dug. It was like a well, and it was used to take water that was used for brewing, actually, because the Romans quite liked their beer. And then after that had we stopped using that for brewing, people used it to throw coins and other objects into the pit as good luck tokens or as offerings to the gods. But the muddy conditions, the eggs sunk into the pit. And it was very soft mud, so the mud in it didn't crush the eggs. And in those muddy, waterlogged conditions, there's no air getting into the pit. And that prevents all the bacteria and other things that usually break down things like wood or food or things like that. That stopped it from breaking those objects down. So they were preserved and we were able to find them. And that was an amazing discovery.
When we see about archaeology on telly and in movies, the race is always for gold or buried treasure. But you're really excited by finding an egg. So what does this egg mean for wider archaeology? Why is this so important? Why has it got you so excited?
Firstly, it's exciting simply because we never find anything like this before. As an archaeologist, well, I get excited, as you say, not by treasure or gold or anything like that, but I want to know about the people who lived in the past, and it's their normal everyday activities, all the sort of things that what they did, how they threw away their rubbish, quite ordinary questions. That's what I'm really interested in. And actually, having this egg, it wasn't used for food because it was whole. But actually, that's what I deal with a lot of pottery, for instance. You know, these are the cooking pots and the drinking cups and things like that, which people in the past used. This is what I love looking at reconstructing all the sort of daily lives of the people who lived in the Roman times in Britain. And the egg was just part of that. It's, you know, people were quite religious and they believed in the spirits that they inhabited, you know, things like watery places. So the egg was a food offering to those spirits who lived in these watery places. And it's these sort of things that I love teasing out of the remains that we excavate.
Oh, it's been such a joy. Thank you for telling us all about the egg. Edward Biddulph, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much to Edward Biddulph. Brilliant to hear all about eggs that stay, that stick around for thousands of years. Can you just imagine the rich soil that would have kept it contained so it was still there unbroken almost 2,000 years later? We'll have another expert in a second answering a question of yours. I love doing this. Every week I get your questions sent through by voice note, through the funkidslive.com or over on the free Fun Kids app, and we get to work. We try and answer them for you. First question this week was sent to me. It's from someone called Games Mode X, who wants to know, why is space so cold when the sun is scorching? Why can't it heat it up? That's a brilliant question, isn't it? Have you ever thought, we get all of our heat from the sun, we're in space, why is the rest of space so famously cold? It's because it's a vacuum. There are very few things in it, almost no particles, and heat is passed when energy moves from one particle to another. So since there aren't really any particles in space, there's nothing for the heat to be passed between. The sun makes energy and it spreads it through radiation, right? That's where heat moves through energy waves. When these get from our sun to Earth, we absorb it and we use that energy. Thing is, because most of space is empty and there are such huge distances between planets, the energy has to travel too far for it to really make any difference. And when it finally reaches somewhere light years away, it just doesn't do anything because it's a bit weaker by that point. The waves die out. And that is why space is so cold. Games Mode X, thank you so much for the question. Let's get on another question. I love these voice notes. This is from Lucas.
Why are some people allergic to stuff?
Lucas, thank you so much for that question, all about allergies. Let's get the answer to help us with that. We're chatting to Dr. Guru Raj Arumugakani from the London Allergy Clinic. Dr. Guru Raj, thank you so much for joining us. So, it is a strange thing with our bodies. It makes us sneeze, it makes us get rashes and itch, these allergies. Why do we get them?
Okay, so if you think about what are the agents that cause allergies, they are meant to be innocuous or harmless substances So if what normally defenses the immune system, but that's mainly to defend against harmful agents like bugs and so on. So why is it kind of reacting to innocuous agents? So that's the kind of gist of this question. So essentially, you wouldn't expect your immune system to react to this. One theory is when the immune system sees these things in the context of something else that's happening in your body, it can view these things as harmful, which are not necessarily harmful to begin with. So then it starts to mount what you call an immune response against these things. Usually you don't, but in certain people, for these reasons, you start recognizing these things as harmful. So there are various theories why that happens. So one thing is how you get exposed to these agents. Say, for example, foods, when they go through the normal bowels, they are recognized as harmless. So you're almost protected from sensing them as harmful. But if they get exposed through other reasons or other areas, like through your breathing or through your skin, then the immune system starts thinking this is a harmful agent. So that's one theory. And another theory is nowadays the immune system sees less and less infections. So it's almost like an idle mind is a devil's workshop kind of situation. So it starts kind of behaving in an unusual fashion against things which are not necessarily harmful when it's not being stimulated in the usual way. It tends to get stimulated to fight against a classical infection. So that's the other theory.
Right. Okay. So it's our body and our immune system,
yeah,
which is getting ready for invaders. It knows, yeah, what they normally look like, these bugs, this bacteria, and it gets confused and thinks other stuff are those invaders. That makes perfect sense. What's interesting, though, it's sometimes the same things, isn't it? So we get hay fever. I suffer from hay fever, an allergy to pollen. Some people might be allergic to nuts, for instance. Do we know why common areas of us being allergic to the things are the same? Why a lot of people are allergic to nuts, but maybe not other foods?
There are two aspects to it. One is the food or the allergen in question. So some tend to be generally more allergic than others. And the other thing is how your immune system tends to see them. Say, for example, the proteins that are more stable, they tend to persist longer to become more allergic. So if it's degraded a bit more easily, then they cease to last long enough to trigger the immune system. So basically, each time when you are getting exposed, your immune system comes across and decides it's not harmful, so it doesn't generate any reactions. At some point, the switch flicks, and then at that point, this is an event called sensitization event. After the sensitization happens, every single time when you come across this pollen or, for example, nuts, you start reacting.
Is there anything that kind of scientists want us to do if we are allergic? Obviously, you know, if we've got a nut allergy, you don't want us to eat loads of nuts. But is there anything we can do to let our bodies know you're confused, this is not an invader, this is just a bit of grass?
Children should do what they would normally do, like attend school, attend nurseries, and not try to confine themselves in a social bubble. So just have your normal childhood interaction with others. That itself probably triggers your immune system. Having this low-grade infections probably, in a way, allows the proper development of your immune system that in turn might also reduce the risk of allergies. Essentially, something you are doing that's making you allergic, just carry on as normal. It's few things that's beyond our control.
Well, there's so much to go on there. Really, thank you so much for helping us answer that question. Dr. Guru Raj, thank you so much for coming on. Let's get into this week's Dangerous Dan then. Our podcast is bigger and better than ever, stuffed full of more wow, and we fit in the most amazing, strange, unique and deadly beasts in the world. And for this week, we are headed to the United States to look at a very strange salamander. You'll find the marbled salamander across the eastern parts of the US. It's an amphibian. Usually they look quite slimy, a little like a small lizard. This one, the marbled one, is normally thick with black and white bands all across it. They live in forests, woodlands, and places with wet soil because they do something quite special. Most amphibians lay their eggs in water, right? But the marbled salamander does it in soil, wet, slightly muddy ground, which is unusual, but fine. But when we're talking about how it gets on with other animals, well, it gets very unique. When they're under attack, they swing their heads about like they're trying to butt something. They look very aggressive. They thrash their tail, which is important. They're trying to draw attention to it because they sweat out a small toxic liquid, which is very irritating and quite dangerous to anything which goes near it and grabs it. So it's saying, look, if it's getting attacked, look at my tail, because it knows that tail can do great harm. That's where it's dangerous. And that is why the marbled salamander goes onto our Dangerous Dan list. It's time for Battle of the Sciences now, then, when every week an expert comes on to prove that theirs is the best, that their field comes first. Today, we're looking into the body with Professor Adam Taylor from Lancaster University, who is here to make the case for anatomy. Adam, thank you for joining us. You have 1 minute to tell us why anatomy is the best, starting in 3, 2, 1. Take it away.
So anatomy is one of the oldest sciences known to man. It dates back to the ancient Greeks, the ancient Egyptians, and before. It's a science that involves examination of the body, and that's the body as we look at it, as we look at each other and ourselves in the mirror, or our siblings, our family members, and seeing the differences on the surface. But it's also about looking deeper inside the body and really getting to grips with what goes on beneath the surface. Every piece of anatomy that we have in our body helps us do everything that we do from day to day. It's a science that the Egyptians and the Greeks spent a lot of time investing in and investigating. Some of what they told us were correct, some of us, what they told us was less correct. But anatomy is that one piece of scientific apparatus that every person on the planet has access to. They have their own working model, and that's where I think anatomy is the best science.
There we go. There's your minute, Adam. So tightly and brilliantly fought then. And it's raised a few questions. You mentioned the Greeks and the Egyptians and what they knew, and they were right about some things and wrong about other things. What do we still use today that they figured out thousands of years ago?
There was a lot of interest from the Egyptians and the Greeks' perspective around the heart and the search for the soul. They knew that the heart was important in relation to its functionality. What they were less correct about was the way that the different blood vessels that we recognize in the body today and the different vessels that transport blood around the body, they thought that some of them were linked to things like the soul, some of them were linked to things that we desire, and some of them were linked to breathing. And actually, we find out that that's a very different to what they expected. We know now that the heart is the key organ in terms of function. We know that arteries take blood away from the heart, veins bring blood back to the heart, and that they connect to every individual organ and tissue in the body. Their view of that was very different, and it wasn't until some of the more well-known names such as Galen, Vesalius and people like that that came later on that we actually began to dispel some of those myths, and we're still doing that today. A lot of advance in anatomy happened in the last 200 to 300 years in terms of understanding the body and how it fits together.
What's amazing is that I feel like I know my body pretty well, and I feel like scientists know everything about what goes on in our body. What are you still doing every day, Adam? What questions are you asking? What are you trying to find out to further our understanding of anatomy?
The one big area that's really posing queries for anatomists, medics and scientists more broadly is the nervous system. We know that imaging the nervous system is challenging, and we're still learning on almost on a monthly basis or day by day basis that our nervous system is connected to all sorts of different bits of our body in a way that we never really knew before. The nervous system is almost the final frontier in terms of understanding what's going on. The other area that people are interested in, and not just from an anatomical perspective, is our gastrointestinal system, our mouth through to our anus, the cells and the other things that live inside us that help us digest food. We're beginning to discover that actually we have a very intricate and very delicately balanced relationship with those bacteria that live inside our gastrointestinal tract. So the nervous system and the insides of our gastrointestinal tract are two areas that still bring scientific discovery. They still bring new science to us as scientists every day.
Wow, because it's like a garden, right? That's in our gut and we're feeding it with everything. And I'm told to eat yogurts and nuts all the time.
That's the question, isn't it? And your microbiome and every individual listener's microbiome is slightly different. And a garden is a great analogy because everything grows in there. And sometimes when you put the wrong thing in there, it kills everything. You know, and that's when we're, for example, when we're sick or we've got an upset stomach, and getting that balance between what works for us. Yogurt is very good. And we're seeing that, you know, the lactobacilli and other constituents of yogurt, actually these probiotic things can be beneficial. And it's about getting that balance, as with everything. Too much of one thing is a bad thing, but a reasonable bit of everything seems to be the right thing for us. But yes, our microbiome is another frontier that we're still exploring.
Now, when you finish your job as a professor of anatomy, right, when you kind of call it a day, you sit on your sofa, what's the one thing that you really want to know? What do you want to discover in the next 10, 20 years?
Oh, that's a great question. So for me, I think one of the things that really interests me is what everybody knows about their body and how we basically get from being we're made from two cells, one from our mum and one from our dad, and how that process yields this huge human that we look at in front of us. So at the end of the day, when I'm finished, the more I can understand about the things that actually, you know, the wonder of two cells coming together to create a whole new human being, and the processes that drive that and things that affect that. That's, you know, looking back when I finished doing what I'm doing, that for me is one of the wonders of life, but also one of the wonders of being human. This process that we see two tiny, tiny cells that we struggle to see with the naked eye come together and form a newborn baby in a period of 9 months. It is a staggering, staggering process, and one that amazes me we get right so many times on the planet every single day.
Well, there we go. With all the answers for anatomy, Professor Adam Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Dan. That's been great. Thanks for having me on.
What do you think, then? Is anatomy the best of the sciences? We'll hear from another expert same time next week who will try to prove why their field is first. While we're in the body, should we stay there with one of our favourite geniuses? This is an episode from our Professor Hallock's series. He knows everything about what happens inside you. This is Kaleidoscopic Antibiotics, where we're finding out, with Professor Hallock's and Nurse Nanobot, how our body protects us.
Professor Hallock's Kaleidoscopic Antibiotic. I think I need a replacement body. Mine's rubbish.
Oh, come on, that's not true. Your body is doing a great job of protecting you from infections.
Doesn't feel like it. Go on, do us a favour and take a look inside me, would you, Nanobot?
Oh, all right. I'll charge up the heli-telly bubble and get down to the size of an atom to investigate. Back in a jiffy.
Heli-telly bubble, ready for launch in 3, 2, 1.
Gosh. It's getting hot as we approach the professor's skin. He's got quite a fever.
Welcome to the immune system in action. Microbes like being at the body's normal temperature, 37 degrees Celsius. They don't like it when the body raises the temperature to help fight off infections. That's what happens when you have a fever.
Even at this size, it's very difficult to get inside a human body. Skin is designed to be a tough, waterproof barrier that keeps foreign things out. That's why if you have a cut or a graze, it's a good idea to wash and cover up so that infections can't sneak in. Let's try somewhere different. Setting coordinates for the ear.
Oh, it tickles. Careful as you go. Don't bonk me on the stirrup.
Even where there are holes, like your ears and nose, you'll find substances like mucus, earwax and hairs, all designed to trap particles and viruses. And the professor certainly has got hairy ears. Hold on.
in 4 micrometers, bear right on the eustachian tube and merge with the throat.
Travelling down the professor's lungs now. Left a bit. Oh! He's got a chest infection by the look of it. I can see Streptococcus pneumoniae bacteria. There's certainly a lot of them around, gathering in pairs. No wonder he's feeling so grotty.
White blood cells have been detected. The body's immune system has been activated.
As you may know, there's more to blood than just, well, blood. As well as red blood cells that carry oxygen to all parts of the body, platelets and other substances suspended in a fluid called plasma, blood also contains white blood cells that help the body fight infections. Look, here comes a lymphocyte. That's a type of white blood cell coming to the rescue.
Some lymphocytes produce special proteins called antibodies, which attach to the surface of the harmful microbe, like a key in a lock, helping to destroy them. Different lymphocytes have different keys, so sometimes it takes a while for the human body to find the right match. But when it is found, the microbes are in trouble. Sometimes antibodies will cause the harmful microbes to burst open to prevent them from reproducing.
What's going on in there, Nanobot?
If I'm right, this lymphocyte is using its antibodies to alert the phagocytes. They're a different type of white blood cell. Yup, here they come. They're chasing the bacteria and are eating it. Incredible! Although I don't want them to think I'm a harmful bacteria. Time to go. I think we're being followed.
The clever thing about the immune system is that once white blood cells have successfully defeated a bacteria, other cells, called memory cells, remain in the body. This way, if the same microbe appears again, the body has its defences ready.
I do believe I'm feeling a little better, Nanobot. Thanks for giving me a checkup.
Don't thank me. Thank those hard-working white blood cells and all your other body's defences.
Professor Hallex's Kaleidoscopic Antibiotic, with support from eBug and Public Health England. Find out more at funkidslive.com/hallux or visit e-bug.eu. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back same time next week with more Mysteries of the Universe Explained. If you have a question you want answered by me or any of our experts, make sure you leave it as a voice note on the free Fun Kids app or at funkidslive.com. You heard from Professor Hallex a second ago. You can hear loads more brilliant podcast series. Wherever you get your shows, they're on Google, Apple, Spotify, and on the Fun Kids website. And Fun Kids, we are a children's radio station from the UK. Listen all over the country on the free Fun Kids app at funkidslive.com. And wake up your smart speaker and ask it to play Fun Kids.